You're a pussy, I declared, leaping to Pierce's defense both figuratively and literally. Pierce was a lot of things. Asshole, jerk, prick, but definitely not a pussy. Christy's eyes shone with amusement.
Now, now, Fritz, we should be more understanding of Pierce's anxieties.
I don't have anxiety,
Pierce growled.
If you say so, her lips pursed. You've never suffered from shyness either, so I don't understand this whole tall, dark, and brooding thing you have going on now.
Pierce exchanged a long look with Dr. Nikus. Then he jerked his shoulders up in a shrug.
Fine. I'll give you a damn sample.
Christy gestured grandly to the chair I'd vacated and gave him a sly look.
Remember that time Nicole asked you to take your shirt off in the middle of a meeting? You didn't even hesitate. Perhaps you'd be willing to give us a repeat performance. Far better than simply rolling up your sleeve.
I was undercover and playing my part, he said, but then, to my astonishment, he gave her a cocky wink and tugged his shirt from his waistband. But I'll oblige, if it'll shut you up.
Her smile widened.
Ah, yes. There's the Pierce Gentry we know and love so well.
I watched, unease rising. Maybe he didn't want to raise suspicion by acting too different from the original Pierce Gentry's personality. But why would he give Christy access to mature zombie blood, even if she didn't know what she had? Pierce pulled the shirt off, exposing chiseled abs and a powerful chest sprinkled with dark curly hair, wide lats that tapered down to a narrow waist, and arms with the perfect amount of muscle.
Woof. Pierce might be over 1,000 years old, but
holy shit, goddamn, he looked good half-naked. Jesus, I was salivating over Pierce.
Well, it's been weird, I said, slapping my confused libido down. But I have to go.
But Angel dear, Christy said, I need more samples.
Yeah, well, I need to get to work. Besides, Jacques already siphoned a whole pint of blood for me.
And yet your body is made up of so much more than blood, isn't it?
Dr. Nikus looked up from the tablet.
Blood is sufficient for our current needs, Christy.
She sniffed, but didn't argue the point. I shot Dr. Nikus a look of gratitude.
I'll come back after work.
Not necessary, Christy said, waving in dismissal. I only needed you here for the samples.
Dr. Nikus held up a placating hand before I could deliver a scathing retort.
Angel is an experienced lab assistant. I need her here.
Fine, she can come.
Her smile turned feral. Besides, I suppose it would be more convenient to have you close by in case I need even more samples. Dr. Nikus moved to me and took my hand.
Thank you for coming in so early.
He pressed a folded piece of paper into my palm.
No problem, I said,
and casually slipped the paper into my pocket.
See you later.
I sauntered out, waved to Billy in the lobby, and didn't look at the secret message until I was in my car. Jacques will switch Pierce's blood sample once away from the other tech, no need to fret. I let out a sigh of relief. Silly me. I should have known Dr. Nikus would take care of things. With that worry settled, I followed the GPS's instructions back to civilization, pulling over once as an ambulance screamed by. My car rocked in the wake, and it suddenly clicked where I'd seen Christy's black-eyed bodyguard before. The roadblock. He was the guy FBI agent Sorsha Aberdeen arrested. So how the hell was he out and about now? And why had Sorsha been after him? I didn't have any answers, but for the first time in the last few god-awful days, I felt as if I finally had a lead, a thread to tug. Maybe it would turn out to be a dead end, but at least I could take some action. Sorsha Aberdeen had arrested Christy's bodyguard for a reason, and I intended to find out why. ASAP. I needed to ask a cop with access to the right info.
and I knew just the one.
Chapter 22. Unfortunately, ASAP would have to be after the autopsies of the two Shambler victims. When I arrived at the morgue, the bodies were waiting, along with Dr. LeBlanc and two doctors I'd never seen before.
Angel, Dr. LeBlanc said, this is Dr. Yolanda Lafferty and Dr. Bernie Reed from the CDC.
I did the polite nice to meet you thing, then excused myself and ran to the bathroom. With the door locked, I Googled both names. Not that I was completely devoid of trust, but I was completely devoid of trust. I breathed a sigh of relief as both appeared to be exactly who they said they were. I didn't know whether having the CDC here was good or bad for the tribe, but their not being obviously Saberton was a definite plus. After sending a quick CDC is here text to Dr. Nikas, I scurried to the cutting room to prep the bodies. I unzipped the first bag to reveal the face of a teenaged boy, Nigel Copper. Sandy blonde hair lay dank against his skull, and his forehead bore a scattering of acne. Heartsick, I opened the second bag, Tristan Copper, and found a young man with similar features but clearly a few years older. Dark stubble covered his jaw, and a gorgeous tattoo of a wolf's head was a spot of color on the pale skin of his upper arm. My stomach churned. These were the brothers Alan had told me about. Only 20 and 17. How could they be dead less than 24 hours after being infected? After a moment to recover my composure, I got the older brother onto the cutting table and made sure all the tools were at hand and ready. Dr. LeBlanc came in with Dr. Lafferty and Dr. Reed, and the autopsy began. Other than some medical lingo, neither of the CDC docs were big conversationalists, which was fine with me. I did my morgue tech duties with quiet efficiency, being careful not to drop any brains this time, and kept my eyes and ears open for anything odd or interesting. As the autopsy proceeded, I picked up the gist of what happened. The older brother had showed symptoms yesterday and bit the younger. The parents didn't know what was going on and took them to an urgent care clinic where both brothers received steroid shots. In the process, both parents were bitten. By the time all were transported to the hospital, the brothers were comatose and the parents were symptomatic. Antibiotics, an antiviral, and an epinephrine drip were administered during the hospital stay, the same as for other patients showing Shambler symptoms. But by morning, the two young men were dead. Mosquito bite, Dr. Lafferty said, pointing to a tiny bump on the side of the older brother's upper arm. She exchanged a significant look with Dr. Reed. This is Louisiana, I pointed out. Mosquito bites aren't exactly rare. I kept my tone light, but inner me huddled in the fetal position. If this shit could be transmitted via mosquito, we were fucked. Dr. Lafferty's mouth pursed. Mosquitoes are vectors for a good number of diseases, including several varieties of encephalitis. By the time we started the autopsy of the younger brother, inner me was rocking and gibbering in a corner. Both victims had a mosquito bite. To my frustration, Dr. Lafferty excised both bites for analysis, leaving no sample for Dr. Nikas. Damn it. The presence of a few bites doesn't mean mosquitoes are spreading the Shambler epidemic, I told myself. But the flimsy self-reassurance didn't ease my worry one bit. After finishing up the second body, Dr. LeBlanc and the CDC doctors left to review results in the main office. Alan returned, and while he helped me get the body sewn up and put away in the cooler, I gave him a quick rundown of the brothers, the steroids, and the bites, both mosquito and human.
I'll get samples of these two for your people, he said as we heaved Tristan Copper, white male, 20 years of age, onto the shelf. Let's hope to God they supply some answers.
I'll ask Philip to swing by for them, I said. Dr. Nikas will want the samples sooner rather than later.
Have him contact me, and I'll make the arrangements. I shoved a laden gurney to the side. I need to go to the sheriff's office to talk to Ben Roth. Is it okay if I do that now?
As long as you make it snappy. No telling how many more of these encephalitis cases will come in.
He glowered at the crowded cooler.
I need to light a fire under the asses of the funeral home so we can move out some of our guests.
I'll be quick, I promised. He stalked off. I shucked my protective gear, grabbed my keys, and pushed open the back door, and yanked it shut again at the sight of a dark green Chevy Impala pulling into the lot. Special Agent Sorsha Aberdeen. Shit. Last thing I needed was to be sucked into a conversation with her.
Hide? Except the only place to hide in the morgue was the cooler, and she might go in there to look at shambler bodies. Besides, I still needed to talk to Ben, and skulking in the cooler didn't fit with Alan's make it snappy order.
Flee. That could work. Keys in hand, I sprinted up the hallway toward the front of the building. At the door to the foyer, I paused and cautiously peered out in case the wily FBI agent had decided to come around to the front. No Sorsha. Only Reb on the phone at the reception desk. Thumbs in my pockets, I sauntered by, gave Reb a wave and smile, then continued out the glass double doors as if I was merely heading to Dear John's for a mid-morning latte. Once out of Reb's field of view, I broke into a run to the corner of the building, then did my sneakiest sneaking around to the back, crouching in the bushes until I could see Sorsha's car parked beneath the morgue entrance overhang. She was still in the driver's seat, talking on her phone, damn it. I stayed put, branches poking my butt, and glanced at my watch. Only 6 times, maybe 7. After 4 agonizing minutes, she climbed out of the Impala and knocked sharply on the morgue door. A few seconds later, Dr. LeBlanc ushered her in. The instant the door closed, I dashed to my car and got my ass out of there. First thing I did was call Dr. Nikas and tell him about the mosquito bites and the details of the CDC visit. Did he cringe every time my name appeared on the caller ID? I couldn't remember the last time I'd phoned him with good news. After I hung up, I made a quick side trip to Big Shop Mart to purchase a toaster, tissue paper, and a gift bag that proclaimed Happy Engagement in bright gold letters. I felt a little guilty using Ben's engagement as an excuse to go see him, but at least it was a darn nice toaster. The sheriff's office HQ was only a couple of miles away, barely outside Tucker Point city limits. The 2-story building was painted a jaundiced yellow with dull beige trim around small windows. The green entryway might have been attractive on its own, but against the sick yellow it looked like a decomp. I stuffed the toaster into the gift bag, shoved tissue paper over it, and fiddled with the arrangement in an attempt to make it look nice. Half a minute later, I muttered, "That's the thought that counts," gave up, and headed inside. After getting directions to Ben's office from the deputy at the front desk, I navigated my way upstairs and down a long hall to the back of the building. His door was ajar, and I peered in to find him parked behind his desk, scowling at his computer screen. "Are they hiding you back here for a reason?" I asked. He looked up, a broad smile replacing the scowl.
"Hey, my angel of death, what brings you here?"
"Prezzies." I set the bag atop the inbox on his desk. His eyes filled with pleased surprise.
"Oh, you didn't have to do that. You're the sweetest."
"You can open it if you want. Or, you know, pull out that crumpled mass of tissue paper, no actual opening required." He chuckled and obliged.
"Oh, wow, a 4-slicer with separate controls. How did you know we needed one? Neil and I both love toast, but we only have a 2-slicer with wonky heating elements. Been meaning to replace it for a month."
"And you can do bagels in it too," I said, delighted that I'd managed to strike gold with the spur-of-the-moment excuse gift.
"That's awesome."
Beaming, he replaced the toaster in the bag. "Hey, I meant to ask you the other day. A guy nearly ran me off the road Monday morning, same day that drowning victim came into the morgue. Then he got stopped at a roadblock a couple miles later and Abadie arrested him. What's the deal with that?
Why don't you ask Abadie?
Ben asked with a mischievous gleam in his eye. 'Cause Abadie and I aren't exactly bosom buds.
You mean because he's a prick?
I was trying to be nice, I paused, but yeah. Ben grinned.
Well, lucky for you, I know the deets since I got past the case. What little there was of it. It was weird. FBI wanted our help nabbing a Reno Larson. Then all they did was charge him with trespassing, criminal mischief, and reckless driving.
Trespassing where?
Admin building for the hospital. You know, the brick single story out back?
The one for authorized personnel only? A tingle started at the base of my skull, telling me this was important.
That's it, he said. Even with the lightweight misdemeanor charges, the guy's bail was crazy high. Way more than anyone would have thought. But he was out 20 minutes after it was set. Didn't even get his car out of impound. Not that it could be driven with 4 blown tires.
Huh. That is weird. Had Sorsha arranged to have the bail set high to try to keep Reno Larson in jail for a while? And why? Did anyone search the car?
Uh-huh. The FBI agent got a warrant, and she and I went over it from top to bottom looking for anything tying him to that building or what he was doing there.
He shrugged.
Didn't find a damn thing. That car was clean. Barely any dirt on the floor mats, even. Abadie thought he saw the guy ditch something small, but a search along that stretch of the highway turned up nada.
Or maybe there's something hidden in the door or hubcaps?
I wondered that myself, but the warrant didn't extend to ripping the car apart, and the agent was hardcore by the book. Didn't want to do anything that might invalidate the search.
He nodded in approval at the adherence to protocol. Yeah, no point in fucking up the case by breaking the rules, right?
Exactly.
Too bad none of this cleared up why Sorsha had asked Bear about me and my dad. Could it be connected to the Larson stuff? Or was she juggling two cases at once? Is this Reno Larson thing the only reason why Agent Aberdeen is in the area?
She said it was part of a much bigger case her task force is working, and that she'd be in the area for a while.
Blech. I glanced at my watch. I need to get back to work. We've been a little busy the last couple of days. He winced.
So I hear. Has anyone pinned down what's causing the outbreak?
The CDC is on it, but they haven't found out anything yet. That much was true. But you might want to wear mosquito repellent just to be safe. And don't let anyone bite you. Same goes for Neil. In any other situation, he'd have laughed, but he simply dipped his head in a grave nod.
10-4. Thanks for the toaster.
Thanks for the info about the roadblock guy. I exited the sheriff's office, musing over the conversation. Law enforcement had to stick to the terms and limits of warrants. Otherwise, any evidence they collected could be considered invalid and useless for getting a conviction. But I wasn't trying to get a conviction or find official evidence. I wasn't limited by pesky legalities. With my plans for tonight set, I returned to the morgue. Chapter 23. 10 minutes before my shift ended, I collected my things and watched the clock tick down. According to Alan, Sorsha's visit to the morgue had been simply to get an update on the Shambler cases, no questions about me, and no new Shambler deaths. But there were 9 new cases at the hospital, which left me itching to get to NewQuest Corps and do my part to help end this whole disaster. Maybe I wasn't as smart and educated as Christy, but I could damn well wash beakers, sterilize equipment, and pipette the hell out of all sorts of shit. The instant the clock ticked to 4 p.m., I grabbed my things and quick-timed it to my car, worry following me. If the infection kept spreading at the current rate, Where would the patients go? Tucker Point Regional Hospital wasn't a large facility, and the shamblers needed to be quarantined and restrained and... A hand grabbed my arm. I shrieked and dropped my bag. Even as the hours and hours of practicing the Ippon Seonage shoulder throw kicked in, I seized my attacker's wrist, pivoted, yanked, and bent in perfect enough form to send him sailing over my shoulder. The man let out a surprised yelp and landed in a heap before me. "Fuck me, Angel," he gasped. "What the hell?" I stared for a second before recognition clicked in. Kang? He looked a good 15 years older. An easy disguise for a mature zombie. "Why'd you jump out at me like that? You scared the shit out of me." Groaning, he clambered to his feet.
"I did not jump out at you. I merely touched your arm."
"Grabbed. You grabbed my arm." With an exasperated huff, I found my keys and unlocked my car. "Get in before someone sees you. Jesus, what were you thinking?"
"I was thinking you asked me to wake up," he said with asperity as he climbed into the passenger seat. "And I wanted to thank you for giving me a way to escape that place."
"You're welcome. Don't make me regret it." Tense, I drove away from the coroner's office and didn't relax until I was sure no one was following us. For all I knew, Pierce had eyes on me in case Kang tried to do exactly what he'd just done and make contact with me. I flicked a quick glance at Kang. "Are you doing all right? I mean, after I woke up from being regrown, it took me a couple of weeks before I could walk without looking like I was three sheets to the wind." He chuckled softly.
"I've picked up a few tricks here and there."
"Ha, I knew it," I grinned. "You were awake the whole time and got used to your new body while pretending to be in a coma."
"Not quite the whole time, but close enough. As far as I can tell, I woke about a day after I came out of the tank. Ariston was in the midst of a rather tense conversation with a man whom I quickly identified as Pietro in a new form. It didn't take me long to suss out. It was in my best interest to feign unconsciousness."
"In other words, you were pretending yesterday when you said you didn't know who Pierce was." He winked.
"Seemed the right move."
"Huh." And Pierce was so insistent he could tell if you were faking it.
"Pierce," Kang said, as if trying out the word for the first time, "isn't as phenomenal as he likes people to think he is."
I cocked an eyebrow. "And you are?" Kang shrugged.
"I've never made claims to greatness."
"Fair enough," I said after a moment's thought. Until Pierce told me how old Kang really was, I'd assumed he was as ordinary as any other zombie. "When you were faking unconsciousness, did you hear everything I said to you?" He sobered.
"I did. And I don't have a solution for your shambler issue. At least, not one that you'll like. Around 1500 years ago in Constantinople, I saw zombies that were wrong, aggressive, but not from brain starvation and seemingly devoid of humanity."
I turned onto a side street. "How were they cured?"
"They weren't." Kang winced. "The infected and anyone who'd been bitten were driven into a house which was then set on fire."
"Oh." I passed a strip mall, then drove into the alley behind it and killed the engine. "Yeah, that's not an option." Kang gave me a long look.
"Other than the current Shambler crisis, you seem to be doing well."
"I am. I've had a few setbacks, but I got my GED last year, and I'm taking classes at Tucker Point Community College."
"That's good to hear," he said. "I confess, when I briefly woke up in the tank, I was quite shocked to see you alive and well.
and even more shocked when I discovered you were welcome in the heart of the tribe's lab. I snickered. A lot's happened since you got your head chopped off.
Yes, I caught up on much of the news via Pierce, albeit unwittingly on his part.
Wicked glee briefly lit his eyes.
I can't help but find it damn funny that you've become such a valuable asset.
I bristled. You don't think I can be a valuable asset?
Don't be silly. That's not what I think at all.
Kang lounged against the passenger door.
I knew from the beginning Marcus was the one who zombified you. Pietro was pissed when he found out Marcus had turned someone without consulting him first.
He chuckled.
And absolutely utterly furious when he learned what kind of person you were.
Drug addict, high school dropout, felon, loser, I supplied cheerfully.
Model citizen, indeed.
He cocked his head.
He wanted to have you killed. In fact, before I got my head chopped off, I didn't expect you to live much longer. But then you went and stopped the zombie killer and saved Marcus's life, yes? I suppose, at that point, Pietro could hardly claim terminating you would be for Marcus's own good.
I remained quiet for a moment as I sorted through my churning thoughts. Pietro hadn't gone so far as to have me killed, but he'd thrown me to the wolves when Christy Charish needed a test subject. Yet, he'd also sent a helicopter to save me and my dad from raging floodwaters, and then loaned me enough money to rebuild our home and our lives. And he'd paid me rather handsomely for doing various work for the tribe. In fact, I had recently discovered that my entire debt had been forgiven. Payment, perhaps, for saving zombies from being exposed to the public. I think Pietro Pierce and I are good now, I finally said. He regarded me, forehead slightly creased as if trying to solve a riddle.
He doesn't trust many people, but he trusts you. Or your intentions, at least.
I met his eyes. I just want zombies to be safe.
And that's what he sees in you. It's all he has ever wanted.
That's why he formed the tribe, right? Kang let out a dry chuckle.
Yes, for better or for worse.
He shook his head.
I'm still not convinced it's a good idea.
I snapped my fingers. Because it draws attention.
Precisely. And attention is seldom kind to those who are different, much less a potential threat.
Sure, but there are huge advantages too, I said. It's a community that helps each other out. It's a safe place, a ready supply of brains, and the latest in zombie healthcare.
I agree.
A light smile played about his mouth.
There are pros and cons. I have yet to decide which way the balance tips.
I fell silent while various thoughts ticked over in my mind. Kang was over 2,000 years old. Of all the amazing cities and communities around the world, why had he settled here in nowhere, Louisiana? Surely not because he was Pierce's zombie daddy.
You're here to keep an eye on Pietro and the tribe, I cried. Pleased when Kang nodded.
Wait, the tribe's been around for hundreds of years, and you still haven't decided whether or not it's a good thing?
No. The tribe, as you know it, has only been around for a couple of decades. Before then, it was a small group of perhaps 4 or 5. Often, it was only Ariston and the man you currently know as Pierce. It was only when Francis Coleman became Pietro Ivanov and gained his holdings, investments, and influence that he was able to organize and expand, helped considerably by technological advances in communication and transportation.
Francis? I snickered. I can't picture Pierce ever being a Francis.
Kang smiled. Francis was a decorated Marine during the conflict in Vietnam.
Hold up,
I glared at him. You mean the Vietnam War that happened in the 20th century, right? Because you burned me once before, making me think you were talking about a recent war instead of an ancient one. This time he laughed. Yes, in the 20th century. He saved 14 U.S. soldiers by taking out a Viet Cong ambush and then literally carrying the wounded men to safety. Quite the badass. I cocked my head. Who was he before he was Francis? Kang pursed his lips and thought. I believe he went by Clarence. Clarence Ambruster. Jesus, that's worse than Francis. Clarence was equally badass in World War I and World War II. I frowned. He sure does love fighting. Kang's expression shadowed. He is skilled in the various arts of war. And as a zombie, he is unusually suited for such a life. Throughout history, a good soldier has always been able to find a job. He paused. Not to mention, a battlefield is an excellent source of brains. I shifted to face him. What does Pierce want from you? I mean, he's been nuts over whatever it is. But obviously, you don't want to tell him. Kang sobered. It's complicated. Try me. He remained silent long enough for me to worry he might bolt to avoid spilling the beans. Have you ever heard of a zombie referred to as mature? He finally asked. Actually, yes. Dr. Nikas told me about them. It's how Pietro Ivanov became Pierce Gentry. Yes, precisely. And you know it has very little to do with age, right? I think I remember him saying that. Good. That saves us a great deal of explanation. He looked up, as if deciding how to proceed. And you're probably aware that a mature zombie has a far higher level of abilities, such as heightened senses. I nodded. Like how Pierce can smell lies and how Dr. Nikas can taste what's wrong with someone. Right. A mature zombie has a greatly reduced need for brains and gains the ability to reshape himself into the form of another by consuming their fresh brain, as you saw for yourself when Pietro became Pierce. Of course, we didn't know the how of it, the DNA reconfiguration, until a few decades ago when Arasan's research unraveled that part of the mystery. He took a deep breath and blew it out in a sigh. Maturation is like an evolution, where host and parasite become one entity, indistinguishable. And, a very long time ago, I figured out a way to trigger that evolution and force the zombie organism to quickly complete the process. Pierce wants to know how to do it, I said.
But I'm guessing you're about to tell me why forcing it is a bad idea.
His shoulders sagged, as if bearing the weight of 2,000 years of existence. I met Pierce, known then as Suleiman, over 1,200 years ago. We became lovers, and a year or so later, I turned him. He... Whoa! My eyes widened. Pierce is gay? Or I guess bi? Holy shit! Kang laughed. No. He has always preferred women. A sly smile lifted a corner of his mouth. I gasped. You were a woman? I grinned as he nodded. Were you smoking hot? He let out a snort of mock disdain. Of course I was. I'd hardly take the form of a hag. More questions burned to be asked, but I made myself focus. Okay, so you and Suleiman were doing the lust and thrust, and you force evolved him? Then something went wrong big time, am I right? Old grief filled his eyes. Suleiman was a soldier, accustomed to killing when necessary. Yet he was also a good man, a tender and considerate lover with the capacity for great compassion and loyalty.
We'd been together nearly 70 years before I forced the change, and I've regretted it for over a millennium. He massaged the center of his forehead, as if trying to physically ease the pain of an old memory. Suleiman's entire personality changed. Almost overnight, he developed a hair-trigger temper and a greatly increased capacity for violence. Not bloodlust or berserker, but cold-blooded and aggressive. Terrifying to be around, even for me. He met my eyes. I couldn't be with him anymore. Although I have always monitored from a distance, it took centuries for the hyper-aggression to fade, such that he regained a measure of his old humanity. That explained a lot. When you pretended to fall asleep again, he went off on Dr. Nakis and punched a wall. That incident was a pale shadow of his former belligerence. It was after Suleiman rescued Ariston from the mob that change for the better began. Ariston was, is, a wellspring of calm. For everyone. I smiled. I've felt the effect about a zillion times. Ariston helped Suleiman regain balance, became a touchstone for the man Suleiman needed to be. Did you force evolve Dr. Nakis too? He shook his head. After the disastrous result with Suleiman, I vowed never to force completion again. Ariston matured naturally, after about 2.5 centuries as a zombie. Is that about when most zombies do the maturing thing? Most zombies never mature, he said to my surprise. It takes the perfect match of person and parasite. There's no way to predict. But yes, if it happens, it's usually after a couple 100 years. If a zombie doesn't mature, what then? Do we just go on living like we are? The relatively few zombies who manage to avoid death by accident or injury can potentially live several 100 years before they lose the ability to repair damage. At that point, they begin to swiftly age and die within a year or so. Huh. And here I'd been thinking I was immortal. Several 100 years isn't a bad haul. Not at all. Kang shrugged. For that matter, I'm sure that even an evolved zombie has a limit to his lifespan, though clearly it's longer than 20 to 100 years plus change. I can't even imagine living that long. It hasn't always been glamorous. He said, face an unreadable mask. 2,000 years. How much tragedy had he seen? How many mature zombies are there in the world? 12, maybe less. He shrugged. Who knows? There aren't all that many zombies in the first place, and only a scant few of them mature, with no known rhyme or reason. Through the years, I've encountered 6 others. None as old as I am, and none younger than Ariston. Christy Charish has a theory that the zombie parasite controls its own population. Maybe it applies to mature zombies too. His eyes narrowed. The doctor who wants to be queen dictator? That's the one. My mouth tightened. Over a year ago, she was trying to create soldiers, zombie soldiers. I was kidnapped to be used as her test subject. She had one of her men shoot Philip Reinhardt, then gave me the choice of making Philip a zombie or watching him die. I couldn't let him die, so I turned him. I rubbed my arms. The very next day, they brought in another volunteer and shot him. But the instinct wasn't there for me like it had been for Philip, and that man died in my arms. Because it doesn't work like that. A variable amount of time is required between turnings, weeks to months, which is why you couldn't save that second man. Found that out the hard way. Christy told me it was because of a population control mechanism with the parasite, due to brains being a limited resource. I suppose that explains why there are so few zombies.
Kang regarded me with calm, ancient eyes.
Is that truly what controls our population?
I made myself consider the question. Even if each zombie made only one new zombie every 6 months, the population would triple each year. Given our long lifespan, after 1,000 years or so, we should have zombies stacked halfway to the moon, which obviously wasn't the case.
It's not the parasite controlling the population, I finally said. It's us. We choose when to make a new zombie.
In fact, as long as I'd been with the tribe, the only two new zombies created were Philip and Andrew Saber, both by me. We're not indiscriminate. We know about the limited food supply. We know that more zombies means more chance of being outed and killed. For self-preservation, we don't go around making zombie babies every time we can, but only when we need or want to. He gave me a sage nod.
We're not driven to create more zombies, ever. There's no zombie hormones that make us fighty. We turn people we care about in order to keep them from dying.
The instinct I had when I made Philip and Andrew into zombies came after I decided I needed to turn them. To save them.
Exactly. We can lay dear Dr. Cherish's hasty theory to rest. Plus, she didn't know about mature zombies, who need far less brains.
So what does it all mean? I asked. He laughed softly.
It means we are both parasite and person.
I cocked my head. Dr. Nakis once told me that the parasite isn't really a parasite. Said calling it a mutualistic symbiont with parasitic aspects was a somewhat better description.
It's a union that creates something entirely new.
He shook his head.
We are still mysteries, even to ourselves.
Less of a mystery every day, thanks to Dr. Nakis. And though I hated to admit it, Christy Charish. Speaking of mysteries, I have a burning personal question. Were you born a woman?
I was, Kang said, though I often took a male form for mere survival. Throughout much of history, a woman without a husband or family to protect her often had a poor outcome.
I tried to imagine myself as a man. What would it feel like to have a dong flopping around?
And just how itchy was ball itch?
So Pierce started out as Suleiman, I said. The name definitely fit him. What was your original name? His eyes darkened.
I don't remember. The parasite protects memory to a vast extent, but I never thought I would live this long. I didn't think to remind myself of certain details, and I've been more people than I can count.
He forced a smile.
I've gone by Kang, or a variation thereof, for several centuries now. Makes it easier to remember who I'm supposed to be.
Damn. Sorry.
My phone buzzed, saving me from the awkward moment.
It's Bear, Nick's dad. I better take this. I hit the answer button. Hey, Bear.
Angel,
he gasped.
I'm at the bowling alley. My people. They turned. They turned Shambler.
Chapter 24.
Call 911. And what do you mean they turned? Your survivalist group?
I called already. They're backed up. Dispatcher said it would be 20 minutes or more. It's six of us here. I don't know what.
Someone yelled in the background.
Jesus. Can you just fucking get here?
I'm only a block away. Hang tight. I disconnected, then started the car and zipped to the bowling alley, narrowly avoiding crashing into an SUV as it careened out of the parking lot at breakneck speed. I drove right up to the front and bailed out. A teenage girl huddled by an ancient Honda Accord, her shirt emblazoned with Alvin's Alley.
Don't go in there, she gasped. They went nuts, and someone shot Gussie.
She hiccuped a sob. Kang dashed for the door. I dragged the girl to her feet. Get in your car and go.
I can't. I left my purse inside.
I shoved my keys into her hand, then get in mine and lock the doors. And if you steal it, I swear I'll hunt you down and do horror movie shit. Now move. She scrambled toward my car. I sprinted into the bowling alley, then flinched at the sound of a gunshot. Across the room, a plastic sign shattered. Stop shooting! I roared, even as Kang leapt over the snack bar and ripped the pistol from the owner's hand, who promptly fled out the front door. With the immediate threat under control, I took stock of the situation. Alvin's Alley was 12 lanes of wholesome family fun decorated in a vaguely 70s retro theme, though with modern computerized scoreboards. It wasn't fancy, but it was clean and safe, except for today. On the floor, beside the nearest bowling ball return, a man with dreadlocks moaned and slavered in a pool of blood. Bear stood at the far end of lane 6 beside a baby-faced man I recognized as one of Bear's sales associates, Clark. Together, they slung pins at two husky black dudes, the Rucker twins. In the next lane over, a woman with orange hair shambled toward them down the oiled surface.
Don't kill them,
Bear shouted, distressed. We won't, I called back, hoping it was true. But how to stop these new shamblers? Dreadlocks man let out a howl and dragged himself toward me, legs apparently useless. In a blur of zombie speed, Kang snatched a towel from the snack bar and bounded to his side, hopefully to stop both Dreadlocks man's advance and the bleeding. The door banged open, and Nick rushed in.
I heard the call on the scanner.
Four shamblers, I hollered. Don't get bit. Using his belt, Kang strapped the folded towel over the wound in Dreadlocks man's back. Clark let out a moan and crumbled.
Shit.
Bear jumped away to the next lane as Clark staggered to his feet, breathing noisily and eyes dead. Make that five shamblers, I said. Damn, he sure turned fast. And Bear was seriously outnumbered now. Nick! Bowling balls! I dodged past Kang and Dreadlocks man to seize one up. Knock them down! I hadn't been bowling since I was a kid, but I wasn't worried about form. With a shout of triumph, I slung the ball down the lane toward Clark, then cursed as the ball sailed into the gutter. Okay, maybe form did matter. Nick sent a ball down the center of his lane, knocking the woman on her ass. I tried again, achieving yet another gutter ball. Fuck! He hit a button on the scoreboard. The rails rose up along the sides of the lane. Kitty rails, try it now. Great. I sucked that hard. But with the rails keeping the ball from the gutter, I managed to knock Clark off his feet. Bowling for zombies, I whooped. Nick took down Rucker 1, but the woman was already clambering up. We need to restrain them, I said, aiming for Rucker 2. Kang, look for duct tape or rope or something.
There's duct tape in my truck,
Bear yelled. He fished keys from his pocket and winged them at us. Kang shot up and snatched them from midair in one fluid move, then sprinted out the door. Nick and I continued to sling bowling balls at the twins, the woman, and Clark, while Bear played keep away and tossed pins. Kang raced in with three rolls of duct tape on each arm. Of course Bear would have a shitload of duct tape, a survivalist's best friend. Bear and Nick, keep them knocked down. I grabbed a stool from the snack bar. I'll pin shamblers while Kang duct tapes them.
I can help,
Bear said. No, it doesn't matter if Kang and I get bit. Bear's gaze snapped to Kang as he realized Kang was a zombie. Nick did too, with an added look of bewilderment. The Kang he knew was not only supposed to be dead, but younger. Nick shook it off and slung another ball at Clark. I ran to the woman and gave her a solid kick to the midsection as she pushed up to her hands and knees. She toppled over, and I jammed the stool over her torso, putting my full weight on it to pin her. Kang! Tape! He was already in motion, wrapping duct tape around her legs with the easy grace of a spider binding its prey. Once her ankles were secured, I tucked the stool aside and helped him get her wrists and mouth bound. He repeated the process with Clark without too much trouble, but my puny weight wasn't enough to hold Rucker One, who was nearly as big as Durrell, the death investigator.
"I'll grab his feet,"
Bear said.
"I won't get bit that way."
He pushed forward and wrapped his arms around the thrashing man's legs, holding on like a bull rider. Nick bowled Rucker Two off his feet, then sprinted down the lane to grab Rucker One's wrists.
"Nick, get back,"
Bear roared.
"Shut up, Dad,"
Nick said through his teeth, clinging on for dear life as Kang bound the man in damn near an entire roll of duct tape. Rucker Two staggered to his feet. Breathing hard, I tackled him behind his knees, sending him crashing to the lane. His head thudded against the divider, and he went limp. Crap. Still breathing, though. We rolled him onto his back as he started to come to and got him trussed up before he could do more than flail a bit. He had a goose egg on his forehead, but at least it wasn't bleeding.
"Need to get the wounded guy, too," I panted.
Kang loped over and took care of taping Dreadlock's man in a flash.
"Gunshot with entry wound in the gut and exit wound in the back," Kang said. "Spinal cord, I'm guessing. Otherwise, he'd have been up as well. I'll stick with him."
Bear rounded on Nick.
"I told you to stay back. Are you hurt? Did you get bitten?"
He ran his hands over Nick like a pat-down until Nick slapped them away.
"I'm not hurt. Are you?"
"No, I'm fine."
Bear gazed around him, agonized.
"My people. Angel, are they going to be okay? They've been part of my survivalist group for over a decade."
"We're going to do everything we can," I told him. "A specialist came down from Chicago, Dr. Christy Charish. You might have seen her on the news."
"The same Christy Charish who locked you up in a cage?"
He gave me an incredulous look.
"You're working with her?"
Shit. Forgot I'd told him all about her right before I brought it apart. "We are. I fucking hate her, but she's the best chance we have of finding a cure." The sound of rapidly approaching sirens put an end to the conversation. I raced to open the door for two paramedics and a frazzled Tucker Point City cop, Seamus Hardy. "We got him restrained," I said as they entered. The older paramedic, his right eye nearly swollen shut, gave me a thumbs up.
"Thank God. That last transport was rough."
"You didn't get bit, did you?" I asked.
"Nope. Clocked by our heel," he said. "What do we have?"
I gestured toward Dreadlock's man. "He has a gunshot wound, and one of the Rucker twins got knocked out for about 10 seconds. The others were trying to bite."
"Got it. More units are on the way."
He rushed to Dreadlock's man while his partner did a quick check of the others. Kang remained crouched beside Dreadlock's man, answering the paramedics' questions. Bear and Nick stood watch over the other shamblers, ready in case any of them broke free. Hardy radioed in a report, then looked my way.
"All five got sick at the same time?"
"Close to it. Within about 5 minutes of each other. Fucking weird."
"Fucking scary is what it is."
His mouth tightened.
"We took so long getting here because the same thing happened across town not half an hour ago. Except it was a bunch of lawyers having their weekly meeting. One went down, then three more followed. Total mayhem. Two paralegals, and the head of the firm got bit, so they're freaking the hell out."
I hissed a curse. "The hospital must be bursting at the seams." Hardy nodded.
"Every EMT crew within a 50-mile radius is on call, and the hospital is full. Emergency triage has been set up at the Tucker High Gym."
My worry tripled. "How is that secure?"
"Restraints. Lots of them."
He lifted his chin toward the downed shamblers.
"The duct tape was good thinking."
I gave him a weak smile. "You know what they say, duct tape and WD-40 can fix anything. If only." The fire department and two other ambulances rolled up. Still reeling from everything Hardy had told me, I retreated outside with Bear, Kang, and Nick. The first pair of paramedics followed us out with Dreadlock's man strapped to a backboard on their stretcher. Once they had him loaded up and were gone, I shared the new info with the others. The pattern has changed, I said. They're turning shamblers sooner. And how the hell can a whole group turn at the same time? This makes no sense.
Dad, are you sure you weren't bitten? Nick asked, voice quavering ever so slightly.
Bear showed Nick his arms.
I'm sure. Some bumps and bruises, that's all.
A sick thought occurred to me. What about mosquito bites?
Nope. Nick already warned me. I'm swimming in deep.
Misery twisted his face.
I brought these guys to the bowling alley to stay inside and keep an eye on them. That lot of good it did.
The naked worry in Nick's eyes didn't ease. I understood it all too well.
I've come to a decision, I announced. Bear, you and my dad are going to stay at the zombie lab until this shit blows over.
Nick turned to me with such a look of gratitude that my knees went weak.
Thank you, he breathed. That's perfect.
Bear puffed up.
No way. I'm not going to run and hide. Shut up, Dad.
Nick clenched his hands.
If you love me at all, you'll do this for me. Be safe.
Bear drew breath to argue, then blew it out.
Jesus Christ. Fine. I'll go. Wherever the hell this place is.
Kang, you can drive Bear's truck, I said. Bear scowled.
I can drive myself.
Nope. Bad idea, I stabbed a finger at him. Like it or not, we still have you on Shambler watch. Turning Shambler behind the wheel would be ugly.
Shit. You're right.
Damn straight I am. I'll call my dad and tell him he has to go. Y'all can swing by and pick him up, then zip straight to the lab.
Kang gave me a sour look.
I just left that wretched place.
I never said you had to stay, I snapped. Drop them off and come back, because God knows we need the help.
Kang lifted his hands in surrender and turned to Bear.
Do you need anything before we go?
Nope. Got a jump bag and a couple of changes of clothes in the truck.
Bear and my dad would be safe, for now at least. Better than nothing. But I also needed to protect Portia, who'd managed to become deeply important to me in a short amount of time. I felt a sharp pang at the thought of that lovely, gentle woman turning into a slavering creature. And Jane. Had Pierce's stalking extended to protecting her?
There's someone else I need you to pick up. Hang on.
I stepped away and found Portia's number, shifted from foot to foot as it rang.
Hello?
Portia, it's Angel, I said in a rush. Please don't think I'm crazy, but the weird encephalitis thing is spreading. Look, I really want you to be safe from infection, so I'm sending a friend over to pick you up and take you... Oh my God, that sounds skeevy as hell.
I'm not sure I understand.
That was the nicest way I'd ever heard anyone say, you're a complete fucking loony. And how could she understand? The whole thing was insanity.
I know, it sounds totally bonkers, but can you please get in touch with Jane Pennington? She'll vouch for me, I hoped. I'm calling her the instant I hang up with you.
Actually, she's right here with me.
For real? Can I please talk to her?
There was a rustling, then another familiar female voice.
Angel?
No need to be vague with Jane. The sick people are infected with the mutated version of the zombie parasite, and it's spreading out of control. I want you and Portia to go to the tribe lab. You'll be safe there.
Marcus called a few minutes ago and said he would send a car for me as soon as I was ready. Victor agrees it's best. I came over to warn Portia to stay inside and use repellent.
At least Pierce was still looking out for Jane. Or maybe Marcus had taken the initiative. Jane's bodyguard, Victor, was great protection under normal circumstances, but he wouldn't be much help against the Shambler disease. It'll take at least 20 minutes for a car to reach you from the lab, I told her. I can have someone there for you and Portia in less than 10. Bear's pickup was a crew cab and could fit 5 adults easily.
Yes, that would be better, Jane agreed, especially for Portia.
In the background, I heard, Jane, what on earth is going on?
Portia, I'll explain everything, but Angel is right. You'll be better off going to a safe place,
To me, she said, "Don't you worry about her, Angel. I'm relieved she's invited." "You're the best," I said fervently, and sent up about a billion prayers of gratitude. "See you both at the lab later." I hung up, glad that particular concern was taken care of, though I'd have to deal with the invited part sooner rather than later. I didn't exactly have the authority to say they could go to the tribe's lab. "Bear, before you and Kang go get my dad, I need y'all to pick up Jane Pennington and her neighbor Portia Antilles. They live in Belle Maison Estates." Bear frowned.
"Jane Pennington, the congresswoman?"
"That's her. I'm texting you the address right now." Bear gave a brusque thumbs up.
"Let's roll, Kang."
They jogged to the truck and took off. Nick watched them go with a curious look on his face. "So, John Kang is back from the dead?" "Sure is. The serial killer's victims were all zombies, and Kang was one of them. We got his head back and regrew him." I allowed myself a grin at Nick's reaction, then turned away to call Marcus. "It's getting worse," I said when he answered.
"I know. Shamblers are turning faster and succumbing in groups."
"It's really fucking bad. I'm sending Bear and my dad to the lab to be safe. They're picking up Jane and another friend of mine, Portia Antilles."
"Jesus, Angel. Your dad and Jane, sure, but we can't turn the lab into a refugee camp."
"Yes, we can," I shouted. "If we're ever going to come out of hiding, we need human allies, and that means we have to be allies to them in return. Now, you have 4 non-zombies heading your way in the next hour, and I swear to God, if you don't roll out the motherfucking welcome mat for each and every one of them, I will burn the goddamn lab to the ground."
"Cripes, Angel. Relax," he exhaled. "You're right, about the allies, not the burning. We'll take good care of them."
My anger subsided. "All right, thanks." And I wouldn't really have burned it down.
"It's okay. I mean, it's concrete, and it would be really hard to... Goodbye, Angel."
The line went dead. Now for the toughest call of all. I started speaking the instant my dad answered. "Dad, you have to go to the tribe lab. Shit's getting worse, and Bear Galatas is coming to get you in about half an hour. Please don't argue with me about this. Please."
"I won't argue, baby," he said. "I can hear it in your voice. I'll be ready when your buddy gets here."
I shuddered in bone-deep relief. "Really? I love you so much, Dad."
"I love you too, Angelkins. You be careful out there, okay?"
"I will. I promise." My hands trembled as I shoved the phone into my pocket. I sat on the curb, closed my eyes, and tried to find a brief moment of balance. A stretcher clattered by, the last of the shamblers being loaded into an ambulance. As the unit roared away, a warm hand gripped mine. I didn't need to open my eyes to know it was Nick. He didn't try to pull me close or hug me, simply held my hand, letting me know he was there. Tears filled my eyes, and I let them fall, crying for the whole awful situation, as well as for how much Nick meant to me. He was an important part of my life, more than I could have ever expected, kind and supportive, a good, decent man. An image swam in my mind, the memory of his face twisted with revulsion at the sight of my rotting body. Yet here he was, unafraid to touch me. My phone buzzed with a text. I pulled my hand away to thumb in my passcode. "From Dr. Nikas. We are monitoring the situation. Do you have access to samples?" I started to reply with a no, then remembered Dreadlocks Man. "I can get you some blood-soaked carpet. That will serve quite well for now." I heaved myself up from the curb. "I need to get some of that bloody carpet for Dr. Nikas." Nick stood.
"I have a box cutter in my car."
At my curious look, a corner of his mouth kicked up. "My dad is a prepper. It rubs off." He retrieved the box cutter and we headed inside. Hardy leaned against the shoe counter talking on his cell phone.
"Yeah, honey, I know I said I'd be home, but we're slammed.
and I'm stuck until the crime scene techs are done here, and they're still 10 minutes out. I promise I'll make it up to...
He went silent and listened.
Crap, I whispered to Nick. We can't exactly cut a hunk of carpet out of a crime scene.
The blood was a dark stain on the worn green carpet, surrounded by discarded gauze and syringe packaging and other EMT debris. Nearby lay the bloody towel Kang had used to slow the bleeding. Taking a towel from the scene would be a really bad idea, but the sight of it gave me a better one. Change of plan. I'm going to snag a clean towel from behind the snack bar and soak up some of the blood with it. As soon as Hardy gets off the phone, keep him distracted. I should only need about 15 seconds.
Got it.
I made my way toward the snack counter as if looking for something I'd dropped. Nick sauntered toward where Hardy continued to try and reason with his honey.
Look, baby, don't hang up on me.
Hardy lowered the phone and stared at it glumly.
Hey, man, Nick said. Can you help me look for my badge? It must have slipped out of my pocket when we were wrestling with the Rucker twins.
He gestured vaguely toward where pins and shattered plastic and debris littered the far end of the lanes.
Sure thing. Hardy shoved his phone in his pocket. Better than trying to talk sense into my girlfriend. You wouldn't believe what she just said to me.
The two ambled down the lanes, with Hardy giving Nick an earful. I ducked behind the snack bar counter, pleased to find a neat stack of white bar towels on a shelf below the popcorn machine. I snagged one, then searched for a bag, but only found a box of gigantic industrial garbage bags under the sink. No sign of anything smaller. It would have to do. I peeled one open as I strolled out to where Dreadlock's man had been shot, casually dropped the towel onto the blood-soaked carpet, then stepped on it with my full weight, lifted off and stepped again, then stuffed the bloody towel into the bag. I was about to close it up when scattered water bottles caught my eye in the area where Bear's people had been sitting. Nice Springs Bottling Company. Water from my hometown. What if something in the water caused the shambling? It made about as much sense as anything else. Nick was still talking to Hardy, but they were coming back up the lane. I grabbed two of the bottles and dropped them into the bag, then rolled it up tight and headed outside. Shit, my keys, I muttered. I'd given them to the scared girl. Maybe she'd left them on the seat? I peered through the window, then almost burst out laughing. The girl cowered in my back seat, eyes squeezed shut. I tapped on the window and she let out a screech. It's safe now, I said, raising my voice so she could hear me through the glass. She shifted to peer out.
Can you get my purse? I don't want to go back inside.
Her lower lip quivered.
It's in the office.
I couldn't blame her. Sure thing. Open the door first. By the time I got my contraband tucked under the front seat, Nick was walking out. After hearing the story, he jogged inside, soon returning with a bright purple bedazzled clutch. The girl scrambled out of the car, snatched the purse from him with a stuttery thanks, then dashed to a pale green Kia. More saddened than amused, I watched her squeal out of the parking lot. She was probably still in high school, too young to see people turn into monsters around her.
Poor kid,
Nick murmured. His hand clasped mine again. I squeezed it back, then forced myself to release it, feeling as if I was tearing free a part of my own self. Nick, I swallowed. I like you. A lot. But you don't know what you're getting into with me. He started to speak, but I shook my head to stop him.
You've seen me rot and fall to pieces. If I don't get brains, that'll happen again. I eat human brains, Nick. It's revolting. And you've never seen me when I'm hungry. I have a monster of a time bomb ticking within me. I'm messed up, weird, and gross. You deserve better. I care about you too much. Like a total coward, I spun away, climbed into my car, and shut the door.
Angel,
muffled. I peeled out in an echo of the girl's departure and didn't look back.
It was stupid. The whole thing was stupid. Like those dumb teen romance movies where I'd yell at the screen at how stupid they were being. But this was reality. And the stakes were too high. Chapter 25. On my way to NewQuest Corps, I passed three mosquito control trucks spraying the ditches. Maybe it was pure coincidence that they were out in force. After all, this area was well known for West Nile virus, but I suspected the CDC had a hand in it, as a precaution. In the nearly deserted NewQuest Corps parking lot, I fished the water bottles from the bag, then stuck them back under the seat. I'd give them to Dr. Nikas later, when Christy wasn't around. At least he wouldn't be snarky if analyzing them turned out to be a waste of time. I headed inside, garbage bag with bloody towel tucked away in my backpack. Instead of Billy, Christy's security guy Reno Larson, aka Car Chase Dude, stood watch by the staircase, regarding me with a smirk as I crossed the lobby. For an instant, I was tempted to call him by name, then decided not to tip my hand that I knew anything about him. Upstairs, Billy leaned against the wall outside the main lab door.
"Afternoon, Miss Crawford," he said cheerfully.
"Hi, Billy, and you can call me Angel. Why are you stuck out here?"
"I'm a glorified gopher, ready and waiting for my next task."
He grinned.
"Wait, did I say glorified?"
I couldn't help but smile. "How long have you been out here?" Though he wore a dark suit like Fritz and Reno, he didn't have the bulge of a gun under his jacket. Apparently he wasn't part of her security team.
"About 3 hours now."
He pondered dramatically for a second.
"Or perhaps it's been 3 days."
"You poor thing," I said with a laugh. "Can't you at least play solitaire or